I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Here we go. This month we're diving into the work of one of the most acclaimed directors in Hollywood history. Six-time Oscar-winning director Frank Capra. Won three times as a director, three others, two for production, one for best documentary. Mm-hmm. Capra directed his first film, a silent documentary short film, in 1921. And fittingly, finished with a documentary short in 1964. But along the way in between, he worked with Clark Gable, Jimmy Stewart, Claudette Colbert, Betty Davis, Spencer Tracy, Katharine Hepburn, Cary Grant, and so many more. His films are best known for their humanistic values, his sense of optimism, and his championing of the little man against rich, greedy, grasping antagonists. It's a style that's been labelled Capra-esque, or if you're feeling less generous, Capricorn. When I was a younger man, I fell under Capra's sway quite a bit, and I was kind of a pretty big fan. I adored the big hits of his I'd seen, you know, but I'd never really delved into his back catalogue, so I was excited that we got this chance to revisit his classics as an adult, and to finally visit some of his other works that I was less familiar with, and, you know, really discover if I still was a Capra fan.
Mm. And before we started this, I'd watched four Capra films, I figured out, and by the time we got to the end of this, I'd watched about 13, so you can see how much we've dived into this. Capra is one of those guys who I had never really studied very much, because he was of his particular brand. Its reputation was of kind of being saccharine or basic, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And particularly at film school, you know, like I was more like noir and Bogart and I like that rough edge, you know, like John Huston or Howard Hawks or those kind of tough guys, you know, or...
I can see how this wouldn't have been your bag.
Yeah. It's been great to look back into these. The pioneering independent filmmaker John Cassavetes once famously said, maybe there really wasn't an America, maybe it was only Frank Capra.
Yeah.
I thought it would be fascinating to revisit Capra in this particular political and social climate that America finds itself in.
Wow, yeah, okay, what a way to look at it, yeah.
And look, Capra has become a byword for American exceptionalism. As Simon said, disparagingly, some critics would call his brand of optimism Capricorn. And he once tellingly said, I made mistakes in drama. I thought drama was when actors cried, but drama is when the audience cries. He's synonymous with a quaint idealism. And the further we get away from Capra's heyday, it seems like almost like kind of a mythic time. Capra is more than his reputation, and is a trailblazing filmmaker with an imperious catalogue that is not only essential viewing, but demands reviewing, as we're about to do in some serious detail. Mm.
Just because I want to give this money to people who need it, they think I'm crazy.
So I'm going to dive into Frank Capra's early life and career. Francesco Rosario Capra emigrated when he was 3 from Sicily to America. He described the experience of staying in steerage as the worst experience of his life, but the one of seeing the Statue of Liberty is one of the greatest. So via Ellis Island, his family settled in California. Capra enrolled in the military during World War I, studied chemical engineering, and thrived at university, but failed at being employed, instead living a kind of Steinbeckian existence, train hopping across America with odd jobs, and finally stumbling into directing his first documentary, a 32-minute piece on an Italian naval vessel visit to San Francisco. Then he made a short film in 1922 called Fulton Fish's Boarding House, a rough-and-tumble narrative about prostitutes and sailors. After which he moved to Los Angeles, where he worked for a comedian, Harry Langdon, and together they made The Strong Man in 1926, and made an international star of Langdon, who in turn downplayed Capra's contribution. Something that Capra would himself later do with one of his own collaborators. The director was downcast, but his luck was about to change when he was hunted out by the founder of a poor performing studio called Columbia. The founder was Harry Cohen. A tough and uncompromising figure, Harry Cohen would easily fit into Cohen brothers' Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
Many have claimed Harry Cohen was cruel. He would bully and argue his way through business dealings. And actress Jean Arthur is rumored to have quit acting because of his treatment.
Oh, wow.
Cohen is a pivotal but complicated player in Capra's career, challenging him, exploiting him, and inspiring him. Cohen gave Capra the opportunity, and the director responded with validating the company, transforming it from cheap movie factory to Oscar-winning factory in just 6 years. One of the most important pictures of Capra's silent era was the film debut of Claudette Colbert in 1927's For the Love of Mike, which performed so badly commercially and critically that Colbert vowed never to make another film, which is a vow I guess she broke.
Yeah.
The other important Capra production of this time was The Power of the Press, starring Mr. Joan Crawford himself, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., as a journalist clearing the name of a woman accused of murder. In 1928, Capra directed 7 films in a single year. Despite the rapidity of filmmaking, Capra felt uneasy with the restraints of the silent movies, so when sound arrived, he was one of the directors who welcomed the transition. In 1929, his first talkie was The Younger Generation, about a Jewish man hiding his ethnicity from his girlfriend to climb the social ladder. In 1931, Capra helped bestow the title that Gene Harlow would become synonymous with, Platinum Blonde. It was not much of a hit, but has grown in significance. The previous year, he had made Ladies of Leisure. The film's writer, Joe Swerling, called the story a putrid piece of gorgonzola and said it was inane, vacuous, pompous, unreal, unbelievable, and incredibly dull. But he wrote the screenplay anyway.
should have put that on the poster.
Yeah, by the scriptwriter himself.
Yeah.
Swerling's entertaining cynicism aside, Ladies of Leisure proved to be the film that Capra made his mark with and helped make a star of Barbara Stanwyck. The star and director combined for 4 films in 4 years. Ladies of Leisure, The Miracle Worker, and Forbidden were hits, but one was not. The Bitter Tea of General Yen. It opens with the burning of a Chinese city, while the beginnings of a happy wedding are in full swing. The bride-to-be, Barbara Stanwyck, finds herself caught up in the commotion and awakes in a local warlord's palatial estate. She wakes from her slumber by gunfire in an opulent bedroom. A striking sequence is when she opens the windows and in the lush flowering gardens below, a firing squad is systematically slaughtering dissidents on the order of General Yen. Stanwyck is such a composed actor that it doesn't feel as though she is ever really a helpless victim. Instead, she has to emotionally grapple with her own attraction come repulsion to General Yen, memorably illustrated in a dream sequence. Yen appears as a kind of racist Nosferatu character, smashing down her bedroom door to attack her. But she is saved by a masked hero who then reveals himself to also be General Yen.
Mm.
Of course, it's needless to say it's uncomfortable to watch any actor donning yellowface. Surprisingly, Swedish actor Nils Aster gives a good performance as the brutal but mannered General Yen. If you can get past that, you know, it
was a thing of the time, though, man.
It is a thing of the time.
And it actually lasted a lot longer than this film.
Yeah, it did. Or Mickey Rooney was still
Mickey Rooney.
Still doing the 60s. And if everyone's going to still keep watching Breakfast at Tiffany's, we can still keep watching Battle of General Yen.
Of course.
Nils Aster and Stanwyck work very well together, and the film actually has quite a bit to say about Western interference in other dominions. The film wasn't a financial success and hurt Stanwyck's image. Just as it was being established, the actress blamed the portrayal of miscegenation, and the film is an example of the topics cinema was dealing with pre-Hays Code. After the bitter reception to The Bitter Tea of General Yen, it was nothing but net for Capra for nearly a decade, starting with Lady for a Day, which was both Capra's first Oscar nomination as a director and, probably more significantly, Columbia Pictures' first ever nominated film for Best Picture. But look, they both win with the next film, the bona fide classic, 1934's It Happened One Night, the Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert hit that redefined romantic comedies. Capra followed this with The Oddity, Broadway Bill, and then perhaps his strongest run of consecutive films. In 1936, his signature film, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, 1937's Lost Horizon, 1938's You Can't Take It With You, starring Gene Arthur and James Stewart, who would reunite the next year in 1939's seminal Capra film, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Mm.
All 4 won Oscars in major categories, and most of them were box office gold. It's during this period from 36 to 41 that Capra and Riskin, who's the writer, crafted their specific archetype, mainly fast-talking, intelligent, jaded woman, usually portrayed by Barbara Stanwyck or Jean Arthur, initially exploits and then slowly won over by charmingly naive out-of-towner either Gary Cooper or James Stewart.
Mm.
Both Deeds and Smith do the most visible work towards building this binary battle of good rural folksiness versus urban greedy cynicism. The writer-director collaboration of Capra and Riskin, that kind of actually presents some subtle shades of grey. But really, the stories are to remind us, the ones who live in these grey areas, that eventually we need to separate certain decisions into black and white for all to see. But one can kind of see why the lasting impression is that Capra portrays small-town American values as having been squashed and ridiculed in the big city, particularly in this era.
Yeah.
And this theme culminates in 1941's Meet John Doe. This is perhaps the beginning of Capra's darker films, opening with a man drilling off the words "Free Press" from the front of a newspaper building and then covered over with a flash news sign promising streamlined news. It's clear to see things maybe haven't changed as much as we thought.
Yeah, wow.
Barbara Stanwyck stars as a journalist creating a character, John Doe, so disgusted by society's issues that he will throw himself off a building on New Year's Eve. The article strikes such a chord with the public that Stanwyck and the newspaper cast John Doe, and they fall on drifter and former baseball minor leaguer Gary Cooper. Cooper becomes a puppet and is basically set up for a disappointment. The film is ambitious but quite messy, especially in the rolling crescendos where Capra and Riskin refuse to commit to any single ending. But after Meet John Doe, America would be confronted with a far more tangible and devastating threat than just the erosion of moral values, and Capra would be one of the most active filmmakers doing his part for his country. I just want to go back onto Riskin. Robert Riskin's
a
really
interesting
character.
Yeah, he's a really important figure to talk about too.
Yeah, I think probably the two big important figures outside of the actors who are there kind of being the mouthpiece for Capra is Harry Cohen and Riskin. So I've already gone about Harry Cohen, but Riskin is a screenwriter and he really does a lot of the social justice is written in there is from him.
Mm.
He was married to Faye Ray, but he had a massive falling out with Capra.
Yeah, over Lost Horizon.
Yeah, that's right. And even later on into Meet John Doe. So, and I think it was 39, so I think it was after Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, they formed their own company. It was called Frank Capra Productions.
Yeah.
Capra got 65% of the profits. He got 35%. And Meet John Doe was a problem. And Riskin, apparently, it's kind of urban myth, and of course Capra denies that it happened, but apparently Riskin was so angry with him, he got a bunch of 120 blank pages and threw them at Capra and said, put the classic Frank Capra touch on that.
Yeah.
And you can kind of see why. I mean, Riskin is really the one, he kind of repeats himself quite a lot, really, in what he's saying, his message, even his story structure.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, you talked briefly about, you called it an oddity, Broadway Bill.
Yeah.
But that's a film that even gets those Riskin kind of messages in there of, that greedy capitalist buying up all the industry. It seemed really weird in a horse racing movie.
Yeah, that's right. I was talking about how the silent comedian Harry Langdon back in 1926 underplayed, in fact, kind of actively rubbished what Capra had brought to the film. Very much felt like Frank Capra had done that to Riskin to some extent.
Yeah, sure. I think that was an era when directors weren't receiving the acclaim that they would begin to receive as well.
That's
the silent era. Yeah. But you're right. I mean, there's definitely the sense that Capra didn't like anyone else having the sense that anyone else was involved in the creation of his masterworks.
Yeah.
He was a big fan of the auteur theory when it came about in the 60s as well, because, I mean, that he loved that, the idea that people would think, it's him, one man, one film.
Exactly. It's that kind of Steve Jobsian kind of ideal of I am this thing. And there's a unifying look to all of that, but there's a lot of players who kind of came in and helped him out, and he probably didn't give credit to him. And what I mean is someone is who's obviously as passionate and principled and articulate and intelligent as Riskin is not just going to cop that as well as part of the industry.
Mm.
You know, like he spent his whole screenwriting career soapboxing. So, of course, if you mistreat him and you're painting yourself as a common man, then he's probably going to make your life hell for a while.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world.
On December the 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and Frank Capra almost immediately quit Hollywood and enlisted as a major in the Signal Corps, tasked with creating orientation films for the armed forces to explain why they were fighting. He was given a short extension which allowed him to complete editing on Arsenic and Old Lace, which would be released in 1944. But aside from that one film, the next 4 years of his life would be devoted to making documentaries for the war effort. Now, it'd be kind of easy, I think, to look at this period of his life and let's say, undervalue what Capra was doing. After all, he was fantastically rich already. He there was a year in the 30s where he made $1 million, which in 30s money is obscene, So there was little financial risk for him taking a couple of years out to work for the government. And it's not like he was going to war and putting his life on the line. He was just more making more films, right? But at the age of 44, when war broke out, Capra was never going to be asked to sign up. And by putting his career on hold, he was doing something only a very few filmmakers did. He joined John Ford, William Wyler, John Huston, and George Stevens as a select group of directors who spent the war documenting the conflict and producing educational films for the war effort. And it must have been a heck of a coup for the armed forces, who now had the best storyteller in films, as General Marshall's aide, Frank McCarthy, described Capra working for them. And by the way, you know I've said often enough on this podcast, I don't watch TV, but there's a great book called Five Come Back by Mark Harris that tells the story of the American directors during the war. And there was a documentary series made of the book, and true to form, I haven't seen it. It's apparently fantastic. I don't know, but the book is a really great read.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah. So there you go. I'm sure there might be people out there who watch that Netflix.
Yeah.
Some of our listeners maybe.
Yeah, there's unlucky people who don't have DVDs.
Yeah, physical media. All right. The war films he'd mostly been known for were the 7 wavy fight films, intended for the troops but released to the public. They were made to justify the US's involvement at a time when plenty still held to a non-interventionist kind of belief. Capra's films are stirring, even if they hardly have the operatic intensity of Germany's Triumph of the Will, which was a film Capra viewed before starting his own series. And they tend to be kind of blunt and unsubtle. You can watch a number of them online. There will be links, obviously, in the show notes. But the narratives are really clear. They're easy to follow. The music's driving to underscore the dread Nazis and the efforts of the heroic allies. Maps unfold Dad's Army styles, you know, with black arrows of Axis forces marching across Europe and the Pacific, thanks to Disney's animation. Whilst white arrows of the Allies stab back at them. His first war film, Prelude to War, won Capra another Oscar, despite the fact that the film went deliberately uncredited. The voiceover might seem a little rich, I think, maybe, by modern standards, but Walter Huston gives it real gravitas. Probably the most challenging to the series for Capra was the Battle of Russia. In the telling, Russia's invasion of Poland is ignored, and rather than draw attention to Stalin's non-aggression pact with Hitler, Capra seems to suggest that Russia had a deliberate strategy just to wear the German attackers down by allowing them to advance deep into Russian territory. It must have been a real headache to get around, because even at the time, I mean, pre-war, you know, there were tensions, so to suddenly have to embrace, you know, a potential foe as your ally. And I think possibly this film would come back and give Capra troubles later on.
Yeah.
Arsenic and Old Lace would be released while Capra was still serving in the army. Cary Grant loathed his performance, which I always find interesting. I think he felt like he was pushed into overacting. But the film was commercial, and it was a commercial and critical hit, even if Capra was pretty much too wrapped up in the war work to really engage with it. The Why We Fight series earned Capra the Legion of Merit in 43 and the Distinguished Service Medal. So, you know, it was really valuable work he was doing. And like I say, it was rare too. There weren't a lot of filmmakers doing what he was doing at the time. After his release from the army, Capra struggled a bit. His first film, It's a Wonderful Life, which we'll talk about in a bit more depth later, lost money for RKO, and Capra found himself in a strange position, having to defend himself as a patriot. Capra talked about having to get cast sign-off from John Wayne. Yeah. A man he regarded as an awful prick for having avoided the war and gotten rich at the same time. Frank claimed to have given John Wayne hell, and perhaps he did, considering that Wayne would later say of Capra, "I'd like to take that little dago son of a bitch and tear him into a million pieces and throw him into the ocean and watch him float back to Sicily where he belongs."
Wow.
Yeah. You know, it's hard to really feel a lot for John Wayne sometimes when you read about, you know, he could have served.
Yeah.
And he found ways to not. And then to talk about somebody who did his part during the war like that is just kind of incredible to me.
Yeah, there's a thing there, isn't there, where I know that he really struggled with that.
Well, he should struggle with it.
And he should, but also not only because he tried to dodge war, but because then he was such a jingoistic, militaristic, built on all of that kind of thing. That he just went over the top. I mean, a lot of people say that Green Berets was all of this this kind of guilt that he felt as well, where he just did all the stuff for the military, like we'll just completely try to paint them in this like beautiful light.
Overcompensating
because he felt awful.
Yeah.
And he must have, absolutely. Yeah.
The fact that he's seen as such the all-American and the patriot and staggering. Look, as communist witch hunts tore through Hollywood, there was talk of Capra's politics being suspect. Based on his film's themes, and his connection to the left-wing writers, some of whom were communists, or perhaps, I love the term, fellow travellers, as I called them during the 30s. His defence was that the writers brought a point of view that went against his own personal beliefs at times. And Capra would turn against some of these writers, naming a few names. One of the other accusations floated against Capra, and it's a term I've heard before, you probably have as well, and it still boggles my mind with its cruelly kind of Orwellian tone, is that he was a premature anti-fascist. it seems it's correct to be against fascism, but suspicious if you're opposed to it a bit too soon, which is craziness. And his film work during the second half of this career, I think, suffered. In his biography, he blamed the hedonists, the homosexuals, the hemophiliac bleeding hearts, the God-haters, the quick-buck artists who substitute shock for talent, who made Capra's seem to be out of step, I guess. Mm. Capra's style to be out of step. State of the Union in 1948, which I found to be a really stagey, talky political drama, with good performances from Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. And it was well reviewed at the time, but a little bit of a struggle, I think, to get through now, because it never really moves out of the sets.
No.
It comes alive.
There's a big chunk in the middle of that film where they're having, like, dinner, and it's crazy. Like,
I'm pretty certain the scene where Spencer Tracy's introduced runs for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is maddening.
But how good is Angela Lansbury in that film?
Yeah, she's great. Yeah, Angela Lansbury as well. I'm talking about Tracy and Hepburn, and yeah. She's wonderful.
She's great. There's a part in the opening where she doesn't blink.
Mm.
It's just psychotic. She doesn't blink. I looked at her and I was like, she's not blinking the whole time. She's delivering for like minutes and minutes and minutes and minutes, and she's delivering all this dialogue.
Yeah.
And people are smoking as well. And that back then it would have been real smoke going in your eyes. You're just like wide-eyed.
It's just one of those films that started out as a stage play and it never grew beyond that stage play. And that's kind of frustrating as a viewer of a movie, I find.
Yeah, that's right.
So Capra remade his earlier film, Broadway Bill, in 1950, into a comedy with musical numbers, Bing Crosby. Amazingly to me, this was the thing that really struck me, because I started watching it and it's like, man, that African-American actor looks a lot like the African-American actor from Broadway Bill. And it is.
Okay.
So Clarence Muse, who's 61 in this film, so he would have been, in his 40s, maybe 46 in the last film, returns as Whitey, the lead's long-suffering stable hand. Although he gets treated a little better this time around and gets a little bit more screen time. He's more of a friend and less of a servant. He doesn't get his ass kicked like he did in Broadway Bill. Crosby's a better fit, too, than the film star Warner Baxter was in the first film, because, in the last podcast I talked about The Maze, how there was like a 25-year age gap. There's a similar age gap between Warner Baxter and Broadway Bill and Myrna Loy, and it's just, I just can't get past it. He's 44, he looks like 54.
Yeah.
She's so young and beautiful.
Also because Warner Baxter didn't like horses, right?
Yeah, he was afraid of horses.
And so I think Capra was like, I want to just remake this one. It's someone who actually likes horses.
Someone who likes horses, yeah.
Which seems crazy.
It's some of the same footage too, by the way.
Right.
Yeah, he took some of the racing footage from Broadway Bill, and it's like, it did back then, it'll do now.
Yeah.
Which I think is pretty funny.
How could he possibly think he's out of step at this point?
Oh, absolutely. cutting edge. I haven't seen Here Comes the Groom from 1951, another Bing Crosby. Again, pretty well received. It's interesting to me, we were talking about Robert Riskin, by now Capra had stopped working with Riskin a long time ago, but this is based on a story by Robert Riskin.
That's right.
So his influence is still being felt, and Capra's still going to that well, I guess.
Mm.
Struggling to get features made and semi-retired and devoted to his avocado plantation at the time, Capra was lured into directing science documentaries for education. Starting with Our Mr. Sun in 1956, he made 3 one-hour shorts that involved actors, animation, and real scientists. Couched in the sort of simplistic delivery that reminds me of the education shorts on the safety of nuclear energy put out by Springfield Nuclear Plant in The Simpsons. Seriously, the son has a chat with Father Time in Our Mr. Sun. You know, everyone's got a mouth and has conversations. And in Hemo the Magnificent, blood is represented by a Greek god-looking character who converses with Disney-like animals. Like there's even a tortoise with one of those, I'm the tortoise kind of slow voices. But these were like the staples of school libraries in the 60s, rolled out and played on the 60mm projectors to enthrall kids the world over. I can remember the projector. Do you remember the projector?
Yeah,
back in the day before the invention of the VCR. And if you had a class and you all went to the library and they got a projector out, it was great. You loved it. And these were the sort of films they were playing. And I'm sure Capra, who in his later years regretted not following his scientific education, because you talked about it, would have loved a chance to make these pure science films and inform a generation. In 59, he directed A Hole in the Head, which was a modest Frank Sinatra hit, before his final film, though not his last directing gig, A Pocket Full of Miracles in 1961, which, it's a slog,
it is.
At over 2.5 hours, it's painfully long. The comedy, which should be sprightly, mostly lags. It's not helped by being set in the 30s, filmed in the 60s by a director who's past his prime. So I can't help but feel out of touch as well, which makes the whole thing feel somehow more dated than you'd imagine possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's like so many removes at that point. Glenn Ford plays to the back rows, and he recruited his then-girlfriend Hope Lang for the plum role of his on-screen girlfriend, which drove a wedge between him and Bette Davis, which apparently made the shoot an horrendous experience. Particularly for Capra, who found the performance of Peter Falk, Oscar-nominated here, the only bright spot of the whole production. The plot, street beggar Davis is dressed as a society lady to fool her own daughter and the aristocratic family she's marrying into, is a soap opera storyline, you know? It's frustratingly light and silly. It's the comic support that kind of almost saves it for me. Falk is great, and I really like veteran Edward Everett Horton as the butler. I thought he was a joy every time he was on screen. Not enough to make this any more than a dull affair, though. And it's frustratingly flatly shot as well.
Yeah, it's very stagey. I watched Broadway Bill, but I haven't watched the remake. But I haven't seen Lady for a Day, but I did watch Pocketful of Miracles. So the other way around.
I'm the same. I haven't seen Lady. So that was a risking film as well. So again, this is a risking film, even though...
And I think Joe Swirling might have done some stuff. So it's kind of funny that basically his last kind of feature film had Swirling and Riskin tied together for the first time, I think.
Yeah, really returning to his roots there in his most successful period and trying to recapture that.
If there's a way that you, listeners out there, can somehow just watch the Peter Falk scenes in this or lines, he is so good.
Oh, he's
he is amazing. Well, I was genuinely laughing out loud when he was delivering lines. Like, his delivery is exceptional in it. And I've always liked Peter Falk, but that was a revelation. Yep. I was like, man, he is so far and away on a different plane than the rest of these actors.
Yeah, and Capra apparently loved working with him.
Yeah, and then, of course, you know, he was a John Cassavetes staple.
Yeah.
So, you know, it all comes around full circle.
But like I say, I also really liked the butler. He was you know, I thought he was great fun. And I was interested, just a small thing. There's a line where a bunch of women come in to dress Bette Davis, you know, and they all come in and there's one guy. And they're like, you can't come in here. And they're like, oh, he can go in there. It's kind of, and it's like, oh, you're trying to say he's a gay guy. And it's like, it's such a weird thing in that time and it's handled so hands-offy.
Yeah.
That was actually Gavin Gordon, who was... Edward Everett Horton's real life partner.
Right.
And that's the only film they ever made together.
Right.
And they probably didn't even interact because they were in such different scenes.
Yeah.
But just a small weird bit of Hollywood.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. There would be no more Frank Capra films, though Capra would push for a number of projects over the next 10 years. But if there was no second act for his life as a filmmaker, there was a second act in his reputation. In 1971, he published his autobiography, The Name Above the Title. And it became a bestseller. He's rediscovered in a sense and went on college lecture tours where a new generation ate up his golden era Hollywood stories and his gilded stories of his own achievements. A real life embodiment of the little man made good who featured in so many of his films. Capra would pass away in 1991 at the age of 94. Hell of a knock.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I love hearing when, you know, someone lives a full life like that, you know. Gets to that age, you know.
Yeah, yeah. What he would have seen in that career and even outside of that career and his life. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. I can't remember the title of one of the last films he was trying to make, but it was a drama set in space, and I remember he was trying to get Jimmy Stewart for it at one stage.
Right.
And his son, Frank Capra Jr., who, of course, went on to be a big-name producer as well, ended up producing it.
Right. Yeah. Probably just a remake of Lost Horizon or something.
Yes. Just another Robert Riskin film.
Yeah. Lost Event Horizon. Set in space.
I'd like to see Lost Event Horizon.
Good mashup.
Yeah, it'd be a great film.
Yeah.
It's inconceivable.
What?
This place, hidden away from the rest of the world, with its glorious concept. And now you come along and confuse me entirely.
Man, we've spoken about a lot of films, haven't we?
Yeah,
we really have. We always do a top five, so we're going to do a top five right now.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So we chose these before we sat down and watched them. So I wouldn't say they're necessarily what we think are the best five Capra films.
No.
The five films that really grabbed our attention or five films we really want to revisit and talk about.
I think if you watch these five films, some of them are the best films he ever did.
Yeah.
And some of them are just so interesting and really unusual. I think you should just watch them all of it, basically.
So I'm going to start with Mr. Deeds Goes to Town from 1936, starring Gary Cooper and Gene Arthur, written by Robert Riskin and directed by Frank Capra. Gary Cooper is Longfellow Deeds, a simple man from small town America who suddenly finds himself the sole heir to an extraordinary fortune. Whisked away to New York, he finds himself the victim of snake-like lawyers, gossipy socialites, and anyone who sees him as an easy way to scam a buck or two. But his biggest challenge comes in the form of spunky reporter Babe Bennett, who goes undercover to get the sensational scoop on this country rube, a job she finds increasingly difficult as she begins to fall for his honest everyman charms. So nominated for Best Picture, writer and actor for Gary Cooper, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town snared Capra his second Best Director Oscar. It's a move for Cooper away from the kind of smouldering sex symbol he was in early roles. Heck, in the same year, he was in a film called Desire with Marlene Dietrich. To see him go to this kind of aw shucks kind of nice guy persona, which he's really good at and would kind of, I think, flavour the rest of his career in some respects. He really seems to have that kind of bone-deep, naive goodness as Deeds, even if his punchiness seems a bit off to modern viewers, you know. He swings his fist pretty freely. He's also so handsome, eh?
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. If, like me, you discovered Coop as the weary sheriff in High Noon from 1952, then this young, gorgeous fella will come as a bit of a shock. You know, I could see why he's such an idol.
Oh, yeah.
And I kind of know him. Like, I had seen this film before, but maybe it was on grainy VHS back in the day, and I didn't really appreciate it. But I really know Coop from his later stage of his career, so it was quite eye-opening to see what a handsome man he was.
Yeah,
Gene Arthur was not the first choice for Babe Bennett. My golden age Hollywood crush, Carol Lombard, took off to make My Man Godfrey with her ex-husband William Powell. Pretty great film itself, which gave Arthur her shot. And she's wonderful, just so totally winning and endlessly charming. She'd go on to star in two more Capra films, You Can't Take It With You in 1938 and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 1939. Capra went over budget on Deeds, which is a rare for him at that time. He was a very contained filmmaker, I guess, and he stuck to his budgets. But he used this as an opportunity to experiment, and it pays off. There are some lovely moments in the film. Coop, staged, like hemmed in by architecture, when forces seemed arrayed against him at the most kind of dramatic time of the film, or liberated as he rockets down a banister like a child. And of course, it has terrific energy. Where I struggled a little bit rewatching it was, and I'm sure we'll return to this sort later on, in the now cliched view of like simple, pure, small-town life thrust up against a vulgar, greedy, scheming city. Deeds' Mandrake Falls is a postcard of a town where everyone is naive and decent, and a man like Deeds has like no end of leisure and relative wealth. I mean, he writes cards, and yet he has servants who bring him food.
Yeah, it's just, and he's not renting out properties to people.
No, I don't know how he exists on that. He seems to be a man of leisure, even before he becomes a man of leisure, you know?
Yeah.
That it all ends in a courtroom drama, something that also feels like kind of maybe a little bit hammy to my modern taste, having seen so many films with courtroom scenes that come in the third act, and just the way that trial ends too, possibly a bit corny as well. Even if Cooper and Arthur sell it for all they're worth, perhaps in this day this was all more novel, but Capra's plot becomes probably a little too smaltzy on this one for me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, remade as Mr. Deeds, starring Adam Sandler and Winona Ryder. So just bringing back Adam Sandler into this conversation.
Yeah, so what you're saying is skip this, just go straight to the Sandler film.
No, I haven't seen the Sandler film. And I think
why would you?
No, gosh. Exactly. But it is interesting because I'd seen this film when I was younger and loved it more than I did on a second view.
Yeah.
And I still like a lot about it. The performances are great. And Capra's always great with comedy moments.
Yeah.
Particularly his supporting cast always works really well.
Yeah.
But something about his worldview just seems naive to me. Yeah. And I don't mean Cooper's worldview. I mean Capra's worldview.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Seems easy and simplistic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I did like about it is the kind of paranoia idea of basically being painted as insane because you see other people suffering and you want to just give them all your fortune.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, this person's crazy. Now, they're obviously lost their mind. We wouldn't want to give away our fortune for this.
Yeah, so why would anyone else? Why would he?
But I love the bodyguards that he's got.
Yeah.
They're just talking to them. She, hey, guys, what's happening, guys? Like, I'm not even exaggerating the accent. This is literally how they talk.
I like the fact that Deeds is, like I say, he's naive and he's a bit of a country rude, but he's never an idiot. And I appreciate that. He's quick to pick up when people are trying to fool him. He's not slow in turning them out, too, when they do, which is great as well. You know, he knows when he's being tricked and he'll respond.
So. Yeah. And this was the first time I'd watched Mr. Deeds. And yeah, I enjoyed it. But there is a simplicity to a lot of Capra's films, but particularly this film.
Yeah, yeah, more so than some of the others I found for some reason. Yeah.
Well, that goes nicely into my first film of the top five, which is almost the second part of this, which is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah.
Look, I can't think of a more poignant film for the exact political moment America finds itself in than Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Jimmy Stewart has had dozens of great films and brilliant performances, but in cinema history, just for performances, there are probably three that tower above. It's A Wonderful Life, Vertigo, and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I mean, there's arguments for, you know, Harvey or Rear Window, but I think performance-wise, those are the three kind of real tour de forces.
Yeah.
This film made Stewart a star, and common rumour is that he won the following year's Best Actor Oscar for The Philadelphia Story as a payback from Hollywood for losing for this film. Stewart plays a trustworthy, honest councilman, picked from Middle America to represent his state in the Senate. A corrupt cabal of self-serving senators and businessmen have banked on exploiting Stewart's wide-eyed inexperience to push through a land deal they will profit from. Stewart is far too green to realise what he should even be paying attention to, but his cynical aide, Jean Arthur, is swayed by his strength of character, and she shows Stewart what is really happening, and they combine forces to stop it. As one reporter says in the film, it is a David versus Goliath battle where David isn't even armed with a catapult. And now, what I found most gratifying rewatching this is how the hokey idealism image he has been cast with can actually kind of be slightly dismantled in this film. Smith, the movie in particular, doesn't show an ideal America with a few bad apples. It shows an entire rotten orchard with a single healthy apple. Mr. Smith is a defined and idealistic man, and this isn't the norm. The American institution of the Senate is shown as fast-moving, deal-making den with self-interest as the priority, where good men are soiled and become part of the problem, where the spirits of Washington and Lincoln have long since been excised. Mr. Smith eventually uses the tools of the Senate to his advantage, but not through law change, but rather to make a corrupted man face himself. Smith is a messianic figure who patiently draws out the goodness he hopes is still inside his false accusers. Stewart plays him with earnest humour and conviction, also very punchy. Just like Gary Cooper. Perhaps never a better fit for Stewart than this role. It's a role that I just don't think anyone these days would be able to pull off. When Stewart talks of his belief in America, you can empathise with Jean Arthur as her hardened shell of cynicism begins to crack. But it's the wonderful actor Claude Rains, so marvellous in Casablanca and Notorious, who has the journey here. He plays a senator, hiding behind the virtuous figure he once was. His degradation is complete when he blackmails, then lies, then attacks Smith's character in a Senate inquiry. Made all the sadder because Rains isn't a cartoon villain, but a man who has gradually taken steps towards corruption over time by rationalising it as playing the game so he can do good things with bad people. Jean Arthur, as you said, Simon, has two vital roles in the Mr. Deeds and Mr. Smith films, and while she's excellent in both, for my money this is a better role. Jean Arthur is instrumental in picking up Stewart's Mr. Smith when he's at his lowest and arming him with the battle plan and tactics to fight back. The emotional connection is with Rains and Arthur's characters rather than Stewart's. They are the Judas and Mary Magdalene characters to his Christ. What is most pleasing on rewatching this is that the film isn't asking the jaded characters or viewers to discover our morals or honesty. It's asking us to rediscover them. They lay dormant, hammered down by defeat, and stagnant from misuse, but they are there. Mr. Smith Goes to Washington still holds up. It is, I believe, screenwriter Robert Riskin's finest hour. It remains a powerhouse performance from Stewart and a great entry-level film for those who want to discover Capra.
Yeah,
I think this is the one to go to. I found this kind of pretty riveting from the get-go. Again, it has a really simplistic ending. It has a view of like, hey, if I just keep hammering away, you know, someone's going to break and finally admit what they've done, which would be nothing short of a miracle in today's modern, you know, you'd be up there forever before someone, senator was like, yeah, actually, I'm completely corrupt. This was originally going to be with Gary Cooper, and it was a sequel to Mr. Deeds.
Yeah.
So it was going to be Mr. Deeds Goes to Washington.
Yeah, I could see that.
They couldn't get Cooper, so they just changed it. And of course, Capra just made You Can't Take It With You with Stewart. So it was like, let's grab him.
Yeah.
And yeah, but I recommend this one to check out. I really enjoyed watching this again.
Yeah, I agree with everything you say, to be honest.
Nice.
Yeah, I think, it, like you say, it makes all the difference that Reigns is a far more complex character than the evil lawyers and Mr. Deeds. It just creates an added level of complexity. And there's a war going on for someone's soul there, which is more interesting than watching just, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The bad guys and good guys.
When he comes in and he's punching through a bunch of journalists and he's kind of saying, well, why don't you tell the truth? And they're like, well, you know, we're going to tell you the truth. And they're explaining to him like what he's being used for. And it's got the great Thomas Mitchell. He was in Stagecoach. He's in a lot of Capra films as well.
Right.
He's so good. You know, he's just the
Capra films always have great supporting cast.
Oh, fantastic supporting cast. Yeah, even in the lesser Capra.
Yep, even lesser Capra.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of the Coen brothers again, how they'll take someone, give them three lines, and you'll remember them forever, you know. And it's the same thing in Capra.
I mean, you know, not that I'm going to take us all the way back to 1934 and talk Broadway Bill again, but there's a couple of actors who played bit parts in that who are my favourite parts of that film.
Yeah.
By far.
Yeah.
And I find myself there thinking a lot of these films are about the characters who come in and out. Like Peter Falk, we talked about him and, before. You know, supporting casts are often competing pretty hard to win the limelight away from the...
And I think H.P. Warner, he always kind of plays the bad
guy
in many of these Capra ones. And he's in this and he's great. He's really assured. And, and again, he's not cartoon. Like, he is the bad guy. Yeah.
All right, so now we're going to go to one that, I tell you what, I wasn't sure whether to do it. Duncan finally talked me around to it. I'm glad he did, because it's a real outlier. That is not Lost Horizon from 1937, starring Ronald Colman and Jane Wyatt, written by Robert Riskin and directed by Frank Capra. Famous diplomat Robert Conway is helping rescue expats from a severing civil war when the plane they're on board crashes somewhere in Tibet. Conway, his brother, and three others are led to a utopia among the mountains called Shangri-La. The peaceful community seemed to offer everything, but could it all be too good to be true? Lost Horizon, like I say, is a Capra oddity. Amongst the stylish comedies of the time, it's an earnest wish fulfillment of a film that imagines a world untouched by war, which was looming at the time this film came out, where people live by a simple maxim, moderation in everything, combined with an almost Buddhist sense of letting go of Western materialism and ambition. So unique in the Capra filmography is Lost Horizon that they almost didn't single it out. But the things that make it different are often the things that make Lost Horizon such an interesting reflection on Capra's obsessions as a filmmaker. It was also a colossal, damaging film at the time, perhaps even a flop, although it would eventually break even. It went massively over time and budget and became Columbia's most expensive film to date. Capra had shot an exorbitant 93-1 shooting ratio. So that's for every foot of film that makes it in, there were 93 feet that he had to film for it. Insanely wasteful for the era. 7 times more excessive than Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, which itself had a pretty generous shooting schedule. Capra's first cut was an unwieldy 6 hours, which became 3.5 for its preview, and finally 132 minutes for its premiere. But edits would continue for years, with different versions being released during the war, and even the copy available today having an audio-only section, which is the version we watched, with stills to cover over the action.
Mm.
The film would win an Oscar for editing, which is perhaps not surprising. But it's still amazing to me that a Frank Capra film, no less, should have lost sequences. You know, from 1937, this was, we talked about this off camera earlier, but this is, you know, the biggest director of the era, and yet he has a film where there are lost parts.
Yeah, it's like Spielberg doing a film and you just couldn't get, you know, 6 minutes of it.
Yeah, it's just like, missing.
yeah,
it is very much like that, actually.
Yeah.
The film caused, or at least added to, the breakdown between Capra, Columbia, and writer Robert Riskin. Became his only new film release between April 36 and September 38. So a long period for the studio to have the most important director dislike on the bench. Lost Horizon is frequently beautiful. The sets are lovely. The snow set scenes near the end are exciting and well-staged. And the opening with our cast making this thrilling escape from a war-torn land has terrific energy. Where the film loses momentum is in the middle section, where Conway and his friends discover Shangri-La. As Capra once admitted himself, I got lost in the architecture. It's only towards the end that I got back on track with human beings. But the problem for me is that the film lacks a conflict. It's actually about avoidance of conflict, which isn't very cinematic. Sure, there are characters who go through internalized battles before ultimately giving in to their new life in this utopia. And Conway's own brother rails against it from start to finish. But otherwise, it's quite a gentle film.
Mm-hmm.
For modern viewers, it's no doubt seems perhaps quaintly patronizing that while Shangri-La is kind of an Eastern paradise, it's really a paradise for the white people. where the happy natives appear to do all the actual kind of physical work, while the Westerners live in luxury. And I'm sure we'll talk about this later when we sum up Capra's career, but the philosophy of this film seems a little vague. The Lama, who's another European as it turns out, describes the ethos as moderation in all things and an absence of struggle. It sounds attractive, of course, and it looks delightful. It's a beautiful film, after all. But it's all a little bit wishy-washy for me. But on the other hand, a film that comes out in 1937, on the eve of another world war, that advocates a kind of isolationism in the Far East, combined with a sort of socialist lifestyle and a stepping away from the craving of the materialism, must have seemed so radical, eh?
Yeah.
It's insane to think that that's on the eve of the Second World War, that film comes out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you think about it, this is, you know, the end of Dust Bowl era, and so capitalism's probably failed people. That's where that communist stuff is, you know, when all this stuff was happening in the 40s and 50s, when it was meetings from the 30s. That's what they were getting them on. Not like, oh, you've been to a meeting last week. So you were in a meeting 10 years ago before the war.
Yeah.
And that's where
the stuff that was tripping people up.
And you can see why. I mean, like America must have looked like, as Mr. Deeds in American Madness talk about, the system is failing. The banks are failing. I mean, that's very much Riskin's point of view, but
Yeah, that's right. Again, we talked about supporting characters. I love Barnett and Lovett, the industrialist and the intellectual, who represent kind of two sides of the Western world who need to both change to find their place in Shangri-La. And this really great sparring, you know. And I love that at the beginning, the intellectual kind of seems just above it all, and he seems to be the guy who needs to change. And then the industrialist gets to Shangri-La, and he's like, oh, have you seen the gold? I don't want them to know I've seen the gold. And so briefly, he gets, you know, enwrapped in that idea of wealth. And eventually they both let go of ambition and wealth and just put into the community.
Another Thomas Mitchell as well again. So he showed up and he's so good.
So good.
Mm. Yeah, I really enjoyed watching Lost Horizon. I hadn't seen it before we started doing this.
Unique, eh?
Yeah, and you'd said, hey, I'm thinking about possibly doing this. And I thought, well, that's great. And especially after I watched it, I was like, yeah, let's talk about that. Because it is such, I would say, out of the films that we've seen, doing this and Bitter Tea of General Yen are the really different Capra films. If you want to see, you know, outside of the box Capra, they're the two to go for. They have things that don't work, but they have enough in there that's really unique. And and still is unusual for modern audiences. I think that they would find that, like, really interesting.
I think this would be an interesting message now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love, it actually kind of reminded me slightly towards the end of The Lost City of Z, that idea of searching for this kind of, as you say, Shangri-La or El Dorado, or, you know, this kind of impossible dream.
Yeah. I love the ending with them trying to get back to Shangri-La and that whole journey, which was apparently, there were several versions of that shot and a real fight over how that would wind up. But I love that last third act, you know?
Yeah. And the last third act's great. You're right. The middle part's the part that kind of pulls a little bit, but that's kind of the point of it. So there's a beauty to it. And the beginning's great, though. The beginning was like a Hitchcock film. Reminded me of, like, Lifeboat or,
it was exciting.
You know, something like that. It was, like, really, really good.
Yeah, this small
good.
Group of people thrown together by this, you know, war and this circumstance.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Stagecoach as well.
Stagecoach,
that sense of these people crammed into this environment. You know, I really liked that. I was really taken by that sequence.
And it also plays with you until the end. You're not quite sure, you know?
Without giving too much away, there is a nice kind of...
There is an upping of the stakes in that last third, which does help.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a really interesting film, though.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I rewatched it. Yeah, absolutely.
This next recommendation is the film that launched a genre.
Mm.
There had been primitive evidence of screwball comedies in films like 1931's The Front Page, which would be later famously remade as His Girl Friday. Screwball comedies aren't wacky slapsticks. They're films that have roots in very particular Shakespearean farce comedies like A Midsummer Night's Dream and Twelfth Night, Mistaken Identities, class-crossed lovers running from a predetermined fate and straight into each other's arms, protagonists who antagonize each other but eventually declare love, usually in the final frame. Capra's 1934 hit It Happened One Night is the prototype for all screwball comedies to come, from 1938's Bringing Up Baby all the way up to Meg Ryan and Kate Hudson films. Claudette Colbert plays Ellie Andrews, a headstrong heiress whose father wants to annul her marriage to a pilot, King Westley.
Mm.
In an act of defiance, Ellie escapes her father's control and begins a journey from Florida to her husband in New York. However, she meets Clark Gable's reporter, Peter Warne, who threatens to tell her father of her whereabouts unless she gives him her story to publish. Claudette Colbert plays the fast-talking socialite who has to adjust her life, not stopping and starting at her convenience. She has excellent chemistry with Gable, and the two-hander scene when they try to hide from private investigators in plain sight by pretending to be a long-married, arguing couple, it's just a delight. In everything she does, Colbert has presence and power, and as Ellie, she expresses the character's fickle nature in a likable way, effortlessly believable as someone used to bending people to her will with either charm or threats. I may be a little controversial here, but as great as Colbert is, this is Gable's film. I don't think that takes anything away from Claudette. It's just that this is probably my favourite Gable performance of all time. He is supremely cool and superbly witty. Whether he's making fun of Colbert or drunkenly self-destructing on the phone to his boss or pretending to be a murderer in order to scare away a competitor away from Ellie's story, Gable is just endlessly watchable in this film. The film critic Andrew Saris described screwball comedies as romantic stories without the sex. And It Happened One Night scraped in just months before the prohibitive Hays Code was introduced to Hollywood. We should really do like a deep dive on the Hays Code.
Yeah, we really should. It's an interesting topic.
And we've brought it up a few times now.
It does get mentioned, yeah.
Yeah. For those that aren't aware, the Hays Code was voluntarily implemented by the American industry because of its lascivious reputation and the fear it would tear at the kind of moral fabric. So swearing, nudity, drugs were outlawed, and violence was heavily restricted. But the reason I bring it up is essentially, here is twofold. First is that It Happened One Night has two iconic scenes that would be confronting the code if it had been in place. The first is Claudette Colbert, while hitchhiking, hitching her skirt up to show off her leg in order to attract a ride. And the second is the scene in which Colbert and Gable share a motel room with only a modesty blanket put up between them. Both characters undress, a bare-chested Gable and a nightie-wearing Colbert throwing underclothes on top of the blanket that divides them. It's difficult to think of these scenes just passing untouched just months later. Yeah. And interestingly, when Gable undressed and he didn't have a vest on, apparently just vest sales
gone. Yeah, it's just the end of the vest.
It just reminded me of when we did the John Woo deep dive and I was talking about, you know, the trench coats and the sunglasses.
Yeah, yeah.
Chow Yun-Fat was wearing. And they just sold out. They just
Look, I don't want to derail us too much, but I was listening to reading a lot about Rudolph Valentino recently, and apparently he used to wear a wristwatch, which was seen as just the height of his kind of feminine kind of, you know, alien nature. The idea of a man having a watch, a piece of jewellery on his wrist to tell the time.
Right.
And yet a few years later, everyone.
Capra's It Happened One Night took the box office and Academy Awards by storm, one of only three films in history to win the Big Five Oscars. Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, Actress, and Actor. Just a quiz note for you later on if you want to know the other ones were, Simon. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And Silence of the Lambs.
Right, there you
go.
See, it would have taken me ages because I would have had
to. You would have to go through every single one.
Yeah, yeah.
For some reason, I always remember those ones. And I just can't imagine that the film's going to do that again.
Yeah.
But, yeah. What is nice to see is that the characters are self-effacing, like when Gable has talked up his kind of near-mythic hitchhiking skills, only to be betrayed by his own rising desperation as a convoy of cars stream past him at high speed, and he's trying all the different hitching signs, and he's just looking more and more panicked. Or when Ellie's father tells her she is acting like a stubborn idiot, she perfectly responds to her father, "I come from a long line of stubborn idiots." Watching It Happen One Night is a vital experience for a film lover, so you can witness the blossoming of an entire subgenre of film. It also remains one of the best examples of that genre.
Yeah.
And away from these academic reasons, it also just holds up so well as a film. While it has some pleasant surprises, it's not so much the story, because you kind of know where it's going, but it's the characters who capture you. Gable and Colbert would become the benchmark for romantic comedies, and they've really been bested.
Yeah, absolutely. It's you talk about the Hays Code, and there's something in it. It's very sexy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the way they relate is as well.
Yeah.
It feels very modern in that sense, at least very free, you know what
I
mean?
Yeah, that's right.
It doesn't have that, it doesn't feel as contained as a lot of the films that came after the Hays Code did.
Yeah.
It's enormous fun. I love this film.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this film. And interesting in this podcast, I keep bringing up the Coen brothers because I actually think they're kind of inspired by Capra in a lot of ways. And I remember them talking about casting Clooney in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And they said, he's Clark Gable.
Yeah.
They said, he's a matinee idol. And in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That's a Clark Gable performance.
Yeah.
And if you imagine Clooney in this and Clark Gable in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I'm sure they'll be interchangeable.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I remember when Clooney first came on the scene as, and when he finished ER, there was a sense he was going to make he was going to become this next big movie star. The Clark Gable comparison was there already, I think, in look.
Yeah.
But you're right, he shows it's more than just look, it's also the performance.
It's the performance, because this is a really, quite a modern performance in how he's doing it. Like I say, particularly when he's going from that, he's doing that drunk and the way it's shot, it's like kind of a close-up on him and all these people are laughing around him, listening to him just bawl out his boss while he's drunk. I just love that. And like I say, that particularly where he's talking about like being able to hitch and having the magic thumb, that's out of our brother, we're out there, and you know, he's shown to be a fool. It's just, it's perfect.
Okay, and on to our final film of our top five. It's A Wonderful Life from 1946, starring James Stewart, Donna Reed, and Lionel Barrymore, written by Francis Goodrich, Albert Hackett, and Frank Capra, and directed by Frank Capra. So for me, this is kind of the biggie in a sense. It's the one that modern-day audiences, if they've heard the name Frank Capra at all, this is the film that I'm known for.
Mm.
Having had the Christmas theme feels wash over them for years after it became a beloved seasonal go-to screening, despite underperforming on its original release, on IMDb, it sits comfortably as the 24th top-rated movie. It was number 3 on the AFI's American Film Institute's top fantasy films list, and it's also been voted as the most inspirational film of all time. And yet, none of that might have happened except for a clearer that meant that It's a Wonderful Life became a public domain movie in the 1970s, leading to TV stations across the states and making it a holiday season staple because, well, they didn't have to pay for it, eh?
Mm.
It's the story of good-hearted George Bailey, who ends up running the family building and loan company and thwarting the evil Mr. Potter, a Dickensian villain who would like to own the small town of Bedford Falls and everyone in it. Bailey spends his life trying to escape the suffocating small town, but finds himself drawn back by duty, love, and his own sense of decency. Until one Christmas Eve, George's Uncle Billy loses $8,000 of the company money. Fearing that he'd be held accountable and sent to prison, George panics and considers taking his own life. Until an angel comes down from heaven in answer to the town's prayers and shows him a vision of what Bedford Falls would look like if George had never been born. So this was almost my favourite Capra film, and watching it again, I don't think my feeling has changed on that. It's so confidently made. It leaps from romance to comedy to near tragedy, and it rockets along at such a pace it seems quite modern. I think if you watch this now, if you're a modern viewer and you're not used to 40s films, it's not going to feel slow. You know, I think it moves so well, and all the ingredients work so well. Stewart's meet cute with Donna Reed is delightful, a joyous first dance that takes place on a dance floor that opens up to drop them into a swimming pool. And when he finally admits his feelings for Reed, who's luminous here, their cheeks almost touching as her New York boyfriend woos her down the phone held between them, the scene is just dripping with longing. Capra's always been great at comedy, and life has a load of great moments. There are delicious exchanges like the cop and the taxi driver, famously named Ernie and Bert, although apparently that's not connected, apparently. Lusting after the gorgeous Violet. As Bert watches Violet slink down the main street, he decides he just might go home and see what the wife is up to. Bailey notes that he's quite the family man, which I think is lovely. Life also is one of my favourite Capra sight gags. It's just a small thing, but it's when Ernie welcomes him, a waterlogged Bailey, out of the rain and into his new home, he leans back against the wall just far enough for his hat to gently tip as Bailey looks down at Ernie's hand held out for a tip. Water running off George's own hat into Ernie's cupped hand. It's just a little, you know, it's a lovely balanced little moment. It's like 3 seconds of screen time, you know?
Yeah.
But it's the sort of thing that Capra, when he was on form, could do so beautifully. And of course, It's a Wonderful Life goes really dark. The slimy Potter, an inspiration for The Simpsons' Mr. Burns, is never punished for any of his misdeeds. He's this wonderfully reptilian creation. And this is the film that introduces us, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, but it really does get into the darker side of the Jimmy Stewart persona. That would be mine and Anthony Mann Weston's, and of course Hitchcock's masterpiece Vertigo. As the universe seems to conspire against George, each event practically weighing on this good man's soul, he eventually snaps, and in a genuinely pretty shocking moment, turns on his Uncle Billy. It's like lifting him up and shaking him and yelling at him, "You silly, stupid old fool, one of us is going to jail, and it's not going to be me." This broken Jimmy Stewart performance is a real revelation, I think. And finally, It's a Wonderful Life is just really moving. The reckless race to the heartwarming finish is something I've seen many times, and even watching again this last weekend, knowing full well what's about to happen, what I was expecting, I found myself in tears again. It just works every time. And part of the reason, I think, and I hadn't really thought about it until this watching, is it's the only true fantasy in the Capra, you know, over. It's sure Lost Horizon dabbled in the supernatural, but this is a fable of a film where an angel takes a man on a journey into an imaginary timeline of the present, and the unreality kind of helps you accept the moral lessons of sacrifice and decency. which at times for me at least felt so cloying in some of his more grounded films. So they felt slightly out of place, but here this feels so right. Either way, however it's achieved, It's a Wonderful Life is a real masterpiece of American cinema.
Can't disagree with any of that. I rewatched this as well. I hadn't seen this film in easily 20 years. It's so dark. Like, it's the darkest feel-good movie you could possibly think of.
Yeah,
I can't think of a darker feel-good movie, which sounds crazy to talk about Capra. He really goes off the rails, you know? He, like, really loses his mind, basically.
Yeah. Like I say, the most villainous character, one of the most villainous in any of Capra's films,
yeah,
isn't punished.
No. It surprised me when I watched this was how long it takes to get to the actual angel showing him. Because it's
long,
really
longer than I expected.
But yeah, it's basically three-quarters of this film is just it's a straightforward linear story.
Yeah.
And then it goes in the last quarter, really. Not even the last third. The last quarter is basically
It is the last quarter. It's like a two-hour film and you're an hour and a half in.
Yeah.
Until you get the visit from the angel.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is surprising to me as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's not surprising that it has a Dick Dickensian feel, like it's Christmas and it's got these nasty characters.
Yeah.
It's a Dickens story, essentially.
Yeah, it's a slight reworking of A Christmas Carol.
That's right. The kid who plays Jimmy Stewart when he's younger is fantastic.
Yes.
He's really, really good. He's really strong.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right. There's a great scene where he has a breakdown, this chemist shop scene where he's crying for his life just about.
Yeah.
Really affecting.
Yeah, yeah. And apparently there's a part where he gets smacked in the ear and he actually did.
He did bleed?
He did bleed. And so that was actually the actor going to the guy like, don't hit me anymore.
Goodness, Yeah, again, for a feel-good film, there is those moments that are really bleak.
But it is so important.
Yeah,
it's such an important film, and it's inspired so many people.
Yeah,
beyond, you know, just of that generation. But as you say, continue to watch it.
And I think I've said more than once on this podcast, when I'm emotionally invested in a film where it has an emotional reaction to me, I can forgive a lot of stuff because you've got something genuinely out of me. And this one does that every time.
Yeah,
which is surprises me.
Yeah,
you know that it has that power. It's a really affecting movie.
Also, the only Capra film on New Zealand Netflix.
Is it right?
It is. Apart from some of his war films.
Well, probably because it cost them nothing.
Yeah, that's right. So get in and have a rewatch of it. It's great.
Yeah, definitely.
I was ready to tell you that a certain man in my state, a Mr. James Taylor, wanted to put through this dam for his own profit. A man who controls a political machine. And controls everything else worth controlling in my state. Yes, and a man even powerful enough to control congressmen. And I saw three of them in his room the day I went up to see him.
Will the senator yield?
No, sir, I will not yield.
So we've gone through Capra's filmography, essentially, from start to finish. And we've also done the top five. That is a great starting place if you're going to watch more.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's one of them. I just want to quickly touch on one, which is Arsenic and Old Lace, which usually out of the top five we did, you'd find Lost Horizon wouldn't be in there and Arsenic and Old Lace would be
that
in there.
That would have been the film to replace if we were going to do it again.
Now, this is one, it's interesting because this is one of the four Capra films I had seen before. And until this time round, it was probably one of my favourites because I was a kid and I watched it all the time and I loved it. Rewatching it, man, it's so stagey. It is overacted.
It was a stage play.
Yeah, that's what I mean. But it's so stagey in how it's done. It's the most stagey.
Yeah.
And it is very overacted, and Cary Grant is very overacting.
Yeah, he was apparently really uncomfortable with it too.
Yeah, and he is complete, and there's so much shouting in it.
Yeah.
It's just like a lot of shouting, and people shouting all the time. There's a couple of great moments from Cary Grant in it though. There's one, there's just these facial contortions when he's figuring out, he's doing all the kind of machinations in his head, and it's great, that's really cool, but a lot of it is quite overbearing, and it's artificial.
Yeah.
But I remember as a kid, this was the film that I remember most fondly of any of the Capra films that I saw as a kid. Because as a kid, I was going, oh yeah, I just have to get through all of this early stuff, you know, with the lovey-doveys, and then it's going to be the creepy dudes who come in.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, bodies turning up in places.
It was a very deliberate attempt to make a different sort of film for Capra as well.
Yeah,
just to, you know, step away from the message, I guess, that he'd been telling with Riskin and do something really different. It was supposed to be Boris Karloff in this film.
Yeah.
And apparently he couldn't get out of the stage play.
Yeah.
So he was never. And I always want to see that film. I want to see the film with Boris Karloff, you know?
He'd be great.
Yeah, he would. I'm really disappointed that it never happened.
Yeah. As you said, Simon, in later years, Capra's autobiography, the name above the title, was a self-aggrandizing but vividly told history of his work, surprisingly not delving into many watershed films like It's a Wonderful Life, but gleefully excoriating actors like Glenn Ford and Claudette Colbert.
Yeah.
Capra was cementing his own myth, and in these years, he was despairing and vitriolic in his criticism of the counterculture, what they had done to cinema, and what they were doing to America. But he was also critical of the Vietnam War, and like Walter Sobchak in The Big Lebowski, he too dabbled in pacifism. Mm. The other thing with Capra is, even with collaborating regularly with cinematographer Robert Walker, Frank Capra is one of the few auteurs who doesn't have a distinct visual style.
Mm.
He preferred wide shots. He wasn't a big one for lingering on close-ups unless they were vitally important for a narratively dramatic moment. There's a really memorable one in It's a Wonderful Life when he's about to walk out and he just walks right up to the camera.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, they're not going to do it without you unless you stay here.
He's quite fond of a well-timed reaction close-up as well.
Yeah.
You know, but when his wife's realizing exactly what he's going through, that they'll punch in for one or something like that. But yeah, there aren't a ton of them.
No, there's not a lot. Even of his stars, even of Claudette Colbert or Barbara Stanwyck, there's not a whole lot, not compared to what else was going on at that time, that's for sure. As the tension and action built, he used more rapid pace of editing. He didn't want to draw attention to his directing. But in the interesting transitional period I mentioned, which is kind of from 1931 to about 34, there are some standout visual flair moments with a hint of gimmickry. Miracle Woman, American Madness, and especially The Bitter Tea of General Yen will have visual, kind of strong, striking visual moments that aren't returned to in later Capra films. Capra also believed in assimilation. All of his films, bar, again, The Bitter Tea of General Yen and The Younger Generation, are devoid of any ethnic diversity in major roles. His American set films are Anglo-Americans fighting against other Anglo-Americans. Although often the lively and warm home lives represented betray his kind of Italian family experience, It's a Wonderful Life has that. Everyone's kind of dancing and singing and joking and playful. And that isn't, you know, that's not a common thing, I think, in other period.
For me, watching Capra now, and I think I talked about it in Mr. D's and knowing what I know about him, it changed the way I feel a little bit about his body of work, because Quinty Simon was all on board with it, you know, his populist everyman stories. Cynical 40s Simon finds to be something a little too easy about his pot shots at, you know, corrupt lawyers and stuff. And I find his own political leanings in his films to be quite vague at times. I just don't know what he's struggling with in Lost Horizon. Is it just really that moderation leads to enlightened happiness? Is it as simple as that? You can probably say this a lot about other filmmakers of the eras Capra worked in, but it's clear that his better future is open to white men only, you know? There are no featured people of colour in any of his films I watched this month, aside from Whitey and Broadway Bill, getting his butt kicked by Warner Baxter, you know. The utopia of Lost Horizon is a whites-only heaven where, despite being set in Asia, only Europeans seem to avoid it, the manual labour. And in Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, the idyllic town of Mandrake Falls is one colour haven, you know, and that colour is white. And do we see Deeds giving any of his fortune to people of colour, you know?
Mm.
And like I say, some of this may be excused by the area he's working in, but Capra made his last film in 1961. So I kind of don't think that argument holds up, particularly since his films are supposed to promote, I heard them described as once, a fantasy of goodwill. That's a very selective fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, thematically, Capra revels in the solitary man standing up and not just fighting, but sacrificing himself for those voices who've been ignored. But as you say, they're white male voices, you know. However, Capra's idealism is problematic because he is a political filmmaker in some ways. Mm. He is trying to say, make political social statements, but he doesn't have any deeper solution other than honesty triumphs greed.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's kind of it. Look, as far as his ongoing legacy, all you need to say is Frank Capra created It's a Wonderful Life. Like, that film's ongoing importance and effect is remarkable.
Mm.
Capra didn't hold up a mirror to America. He held up a beautiful portrait and said, "Isn't this marvellous? This is what we should become." He spoke to the working class people, the average man, and even the rich, and said, "We can all do better." Capra had a love for his country that poured out of him onto the screen, and there will never be a filmmaker as talented as he was at connecting with the American dream.
Yeah.
And he influenced a lot of people. He influenced a big one that I think about, especially when I was watching Mr. Smith, was Oliver Stone. And if you watch, one of my favorite films of all time is JFK.
Yeah.
And if you watch the end of that, it is as schmaltzy. I love JFK, but that Kevin Costner's kind of plea at the end of that goes for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And in real life, Jim Garrison never actually made a closing argument. know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Oliver Stone takes the time, and he does that in that moment.
Yeah, I remember you saying, I mean, not that earlier in the podcast, you said George Clooney could have been in a Capra film.
Yeah.
Costner could have been in a Capra film.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Costner could have been in a Capra film, probably should have been.
Yeah.
But Oliver Stone particularly has that viewpoint. Obviously, it's a lot more developed.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cynicism and darkness in Oliver Stone's work, but there's also a lot of that kind of hope and optimism.
Sure.
And he even extends hands to people like, you know, Richard Nixon, you know, people like that in his films going, hey, he wasn't that bad a guy. Whereas most people just like eviscerate the guy,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I think Stone's a big one. And like I say, if you watch JFK, the end of that, and you watch Mr. Smith, you put him back to back, it's essentially the same thing. It's just someone soapboxing for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, about what he wants America to be.
Yeah, yeah.
About what it should be, what if its principles are this. This is what the reality of it, and this isn't the reality of it.
Yeah.
The reality is these people, you know, stealing away the American dream, basically.
Yeah, look, I obviously it makes it sound like I bagged him a bit in the summary, but I just want to say there are parts of Capra's work that just remain completely undimmed for me. His comedy was what made even the worst of his films tick, you know. He gave stars like Gabriel Cobert, Cooper, and Stewart their most iconic roles, then let them be upstaged by this repertory of colourful character actors. He was a sentimentalist, I mean, to be sure, but when he landed on the right side of the Smoltz, his films were just so effective, you know. His finest films are stirring and optimistic in ways that I don't think any other director's been able to recapture.
No, I don't think there's anyone who's done it before, during, or since, you know. And I think that those, if you tried that now, you just get lambasted.
Yeah, it's so hard to pull off, eh?
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, it's not, like you say, none of his stuff is flawless. Some of it's indulgent, some of it's overlong, some of it's repetitive, but some of it's just amazing. Universal appeal, that it will just keep going and going and going. So, it was a joy to watch a lot of these films, actually.
Yeah, yeah, me too. I mean, even some of his lesser films, you know, this month have been fun to and really enjoyable to watch.
Spoiler alert.
Okay, well, that's Frank Capra in total, as much as we could do it.
Yeah, pretty exhausted. Well, I'm exhausted.
I'm exhausted. Yeah, me too. I just really love that one, as one commentator said, you know, he had a love of America that only an immigrant could have.
Mm.
And I think that's interesting, like the most American director of all time. Actually Italian.
Yeah.
So it's just wonderful. The song we're going out to, Simon, is
Buffalo Girls.
Right.
So this gets a lot of play in It's a Wonderful Life. It's the love song for the for the main couple, for George and his wife there. So and we found a lovely cover of it as well.
Yeah, that's right. By the Pickford family. I have no idea when this was released.
Yeah,
but it seems like an old classic. And I think, you know, it's getting dark times when I think she's trying to sing it to him and he's all like getting angry and you're like, it's not going too well.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great moment where I think she breaks the record at one point as well. She's so frustrated with him.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's a classic. That's turned into a meme, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like people put that on and there'll be some...
Yeah, walking up, pulling it, smashing the album.
Yeah. Someone will overdub like Justin Bieber or something like on there and then it's sort of smashing the thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, search for the GIF.
Yeah. That's right. Thanks to everyone for listening.
Yeah, thank you.
And we'll see you next month.
All right, take care.
Cheers.
As I was walking down the street, down the street, down the street, pretty little girl I chanced to meet under the silvery moon.
Buffalo girl, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo girl, won't you come out tonight? Thanks for the light of the moon.
To be my wife, be my wife, be my wife, and I'd be happy all my life. Skip to Maloo, my darling.
Buffalo girl, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo girl, won't you come out tonight? Thanks for the light of the moon.
Do you love her?
A normal human being couldn't live under the same roof with her without going nutty. She's my idea of nothing.
I asked you a simple question. Do you love her?
Yes! But don't hold that against me. I'm a little screwy myself.